Welcome to the Kildren Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Dunbar. You're joining us for the part two of the Mice of Great Britain episode, and we're picking up where we've left off with Melvin. So that leads us nicely, I guess, onto the Dormice.
Yeah, so Dormice. So we've got, there's actually two species of Dormice in Britain, one native and one non-native. So the native species is the hazel dormouse, which has kind of got this orangey golden fur, and they live in kind of hazel bushes and, you know, roadside verges in the bushes and places like that. And they're found generally in the south of England, and they're fully protected under the Wildlife and Countryside Act of 1981. I mean, all dormice, I mean, they sleep for 7 months of the year, which sounds quite good. I could get used to that.
Yeah, definitely. that sounds fantastic.
but yeah, that's our native dormouse, the hazel dormouse. But we've got an invasive species, which is known as the fat dormouse, sometimes European fat dormouse, or the edible dormouse, because it was a Roman delicacy back in the day. And its scientific name is Glis-Glis, so people often just call them Glis-Glis.
Yeah.
And they look like a kind of very small, like chinchilla-like creature. And they've got a furry tail, not as bushy like a squirrel, but it's still fairly bushy. And they were introduced in Britain in 1902. Where the Rothschild family had a private kind of wildlife collection on their estate, and some fat dormice, Glis-Glis, edible dormice, whatever you want to call them, escaped from their private wildlife collection.
Right.
And for the past 120 plus years, they've caused a bit of a nuisance to people in and around the area of Tring in Hertfordshire.
Right.
And particularly around Amersham, very common in and around Amersham, and sort of being found a bit further out towards Henley on Thames. And yeah, they're quite funny things to watch. And it's greyish, silverish kind of flank to the fur to them, very large, prominent black beady eyes. But yeah, they're quite funny things.
Absolutely. They can be quite destructive, can't they, when they find themselves in properties?
Absolutely, yeah. So they will gnaw electrical cables, chew up insulation. The similar damage that we would see from a grey squirrel.
Yeah.
And they will, because they're an arboreal species, right? They're arboreal, meaning they dwell high up here, off the ground, up in the tree canopies. And when they see a house, right, when they come across a property, a building, a house, that's a tree. All right. So this animal is a tree, and they're amazing climbers, and they'll climb up the brickwork, get into the tiniest little gap in the soffit or under the gutter line or under a roof tile, and they're in. And they will, you know, usually this time of year, you'll be finding them throughout the summer, really, in these roof spaces. Particularly when you get a lot of females, they kind of breed together in a group, we call it a nursery, up in a roofoid, and they'll cause a lot of destruction. And there's a very strong, pungent, sweet smell you get when you get fat dormice within these roof spaces. That's quite amazing.
Yeah, and that's fantastic. So obviously, with them being an invasive species, you know, it'd be on to us to control them. Is controlling them a sort of straightforward process, or do we have to jump through a few hoops?
Yeah, it's a bit of a funny one with Glis-Glis, because although they're an invasive species, the wording in the Wildlife and Countryside Act doesn't specify which dormice, right? It says dormice family Glyridae. So actually, if we're not working under a license to deal with Glis-Glis, we're contravening the Wildlife Countryside Act, even though it's a non-native species, which is a bit strange. All right.
Yeah.
And also we were signed into a European convention called the Berne Convention. And this convention was set out to give certain species a level of protection across all European countries.
Yeah.
As well as flora and fauna as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense for areas where Glis-Glis is native. It makes sense for them to have some legal protection. But for us, it doesn't quite make sense. So in order to legally deal with this species of dormouse, we need to apply for a class license from Natural England, a CLO2. Right. Okay, so you contact Natural England, apply for that license, and that license covers you for the year. All right. And at the beginning of the next following year, you would reapply for that license again. And you need to record how many you trap, mm-hmm. And send that data back to Natural England. So they've got a record of how many are being caught. And of course, as with any non-native species, and actually is listed under Schedule 9 of the Wildlife and Countryside Act as being a destructive non-native species, we mustn't release it. We mustn't release it. It must be dispatched. Okay. But approved methods are using an approved spring trap. At the moment, it's the Solway Mark 6, I believe, which are approved for it. Mm-hmm. And the Good Nature A18 is approved for use on Glis-Glis.
Yep.
And you can live trap it, but then you've got to dispatch it, of course, you know, using an
humanely
appropriate
making
method.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. No, that's brilliant. So obviously, as we're on the topic of sort of control methods, we're going to circle back to some of the other species we've discussed. So obviously, harvest mice, we are to sort of leave alone. They do their thing. They're living in the crops, whatever it may be. Now, here's the part you've all been waiting for, the all-important CPD code. The code for this episode is mischief-cpd-319. That's mischief-cpd-319. Now back to the podcast. So kind of leaves us with it. We know there's a variety of different methods for our good old house mouse, right? There's a variety of anticoagulant rodenticides, cholecalciferol-based rodenticides, trapping, all these side of things. So you've mentioned that there's a cholecalciferol-based product currently approved for control of Apodemus sylvaticus, so the wood mouse. Why aren't there any anticoagulant rodenticides that we can use against that species?
So, yeah, as we all know from our training and, you know, crew, obviously they're a prey animal. All right. Mm-hmm. So, wood mice are predated upon by various birds of prey, including barn owls. 18% of a barn owl's diet is made up of wood mice.
Yeah.
But also, you know, some other predators like stoats and weasels, for example. And of course, when a mouse consumes an anticoagulant, it's chronic. So that animal isn't going to die for several days. It mm-hmm. may be 3 to 10 days before death occurs. And all that time is probably going to be eating more and more and more anticoagulant. So we could actually end up with multiple lethal doses built up within the liver of that wood mouse. So by the time it's preyed upon by a predator, it can be completely loaded up with anticoagulant, and those residues will end up in that other wildlife, right? So that's why we don't use anticoagulants against wood mice, because of the secondary poisoning issue, which we should all be familiar with.
Absolutely. So obviously with cholecalciferol, that risk is, you know, you can never say it's non-existent, because there's always an element of risk when you're using any type of biocide, but that risk is much, much lower of the sort of secondary poisoning and that compound moving onto the predatory animals.
Yeah, we need to be responsible for what we're doing. And actually, you know, wood mice, they are native to Britain. There's fossil records of wood mice being in Britain since the last ice age, you know. And actually, I came across one trapped in a pipe on a site just on Monday. Perhaps in my younger days, technician, I probably would have just dispatched it. But actually, you know, I managed to catch it, and I let it go out in the hedge, you know, because, you know, there was no anticoagulant being used in that area of the site. It's not likely to have been poisoned. I'm not causing any harm, and yeah, it's nowhere near a production area. Might as well let it go. I think a good pasture controller should know when it's appropriate to deal with something or not, you know.
Definitely. And it's a really good point that you made during your talk about this topic, that just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yeah,
right,
absolutely. Yeah,
and that's the thing, because, you know, monitoring levels of Aphidemus sylvaticus or the wood mouse around the site, you know, should be a common practice. We know that we should use non-toxic monitoring methods to establish whether there's any activity, and not every single piece of activity from a wood mouse needs to, you know, you don't need to rain hellfire upon them the moment you spot anything, right?
Yeah. And if you do get wood mice in a building, a classic scenario is a warehouse and you get the odd, you know, bit of mouse activity, and there's a gap under that roller door, usually in the corner of the roller door. And you can be pretty sure it's got in under that gap. And the solution is to proof it out, right? You know,
that's it.
And that's easier said than done, isn't it, with some of our customers, you know, getting them to understand the importance of that, right?
Definitely.
But I'm sure all of the listeners' clients are absolutely perfect and they carry out all their recommendations, yeah?
Oh, absolutely, of course. But yeah, that's the thing. Obviously, we talked about the chemical side of things, but, you know, we can use our usual snap traps for control of wood mice should we find them internally. Obviously, addressing the issue of how they got there should be the first port of call, shall we say. But definitely, I find, at least in my personal experience, you know, we've been controlling house mice for so many years now. There's evidence of bait shyness and bait and trap avoidance and all that side of things. I've not really come across that with wood mice personally. A lot of the time, if you put traps down for them, you're going to catch them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're pretty gullible, and they seem to sort of launch themselves onto breakbat traps, don't they?
So,
I mean, traps can be really useful when you're dealing with small numbers of mice, and with mice, you're only going to get small numbers, so you should be able to solve it with traps, really. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And that kind of leads us nicely on to, you know, what other things can we do to, you know, not only control mice, but sort of minimize the risk of mice around our site. What sort of things should we be looking out for? This is really going back to the basics now.
Yeah, I mean, it's going back to that kind of ERD principle, isn't it? ERD, exclusion, restriction, destruction, right? Big ones like that. The vegetation around the site, right? Yeah, you've all gone around, you've seen the weeds have grown up, the stinging nettles have grown up, the grass, and it obscures those proofing defects. You can't see it, provides cover. So we need to keep the area around the building as clear as possible from cover, make it as inhospitable to rodents as possible. But yeah, so it helps you identify those proofing issues. It eliminates the harborage. Just try and keep it as clear as you can.
That's it.
And you know, identify those potential ingress points and get them proofed, you know. And if your customer isn't going to proof it or hasn't got the time or the resources to do it, then, you know, perhaps that's something you as a pest controller is competent in, and you can offer that service for them, right? So
yeah, 100%. I mean, a lot of the time, you know, customers pay pest controllers to be able to identify the risk, right? People think, oh, I'm going to call the rat man or the rat woman and they're going to get rid of the problem. But that's not a big part of what we do. It's identifying those risks and working with the customer. Part of the integrated pest management is to have one beautiful, harmonious process that involves the customer, you know? That's supposed to work as well as it should.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, where pest awareness comes in quite well, actually, because it helps the client get that deeper understanding that pest control isn't just, oh, we pay this company to come out and the guy comes around and checks, right? It helps them understand that pest control is a partnership. It's a relationship. Like you have a good relationship with the client, you help them understand that they got to do the proof and stack housekeeping recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to do their bit in order for you to be able to do your bit, right? You know, it's that partnership that's really important. And you know, offering pest awareness training to a client can be, whether that's a food factory, a warehouse, or, you know, even other sites as well, where it doesn't necessarily have to be a food factory. I think it I think it'd be really beneficial.
Yeah, 100%. I completely agree with you. Melvin, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Again, thank you so much for taking your time and sort of agreeing to join and have a chat with me on the podcast. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, that the article about what we've just discussed, I believe, is available in issue 139 of the Pest Control News magazine. So if anybody wants to have a bit of a read up on some of the topics, see some pictures of evidence of those mice, because it's kind of difficult to get these points across on the podcast sometimes without some visual aids. So all of those are available for you. And if anyone has any questions about what we've been chatting about, we'll be more than happy to answer them if you contact the technical department at Kiljum.
Brilliant. Thanks, Michael.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Melvin. I'll see you soon.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye. Again, many thanks to Melvin for joining us on the podcast. Make sure to tune in to the next one where we'll be continuing the rodent theme. Over the series of 3 episodes, I'll be joined by Avril Turner, the Kiljum Technical Manager for the Midlands, where we'll be discussing rodent census. See you then.